On This Week in Enterprise Tech, the FBI claims encryption poverty. Adding blockchain to your company's name is the new black. And Sauce Labs is here to explain why manual testing is so last decade. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 263, recorded October 27, 2017, The Secret Sauce of Sauce Labs. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so that you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Welcome to Twyatt. This Week in Enterprise Tech, it's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballister, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. I'm going to need a little help from my friends, starting with Mr. Brian Chi. He is the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii, which is currently under attack from what? Sharks, Russian submarines, crabs drilling into your fiber? What's going on over there?
Who knows? All I know is that for some reason or another, our commodity, not on internet too, but our commodity connection is having issues.
Well, you do live in the middle of the Pacific, so it could be literally anything. Hopefully,
hey, at least I have air conditioning now.
Yeah, so no internet, but air conditioning. I'd actually take that trade-off living on the island. But is it warm over there? It's October.
No, it's actually started dropping in temperature.
All right.
So it's kind of nice now.
Well, up in the wonderful Northwest is Mr. Lou Maresca. He is one of the big guys. We call him our booth babe. He is our booth babe from Microsoft. Lou, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing wonderful. It's actually sunny and almost 60 degrees here in Seattle, so I'm having a good day.
Well, gentlemen, we've got one heck of an episode for the Twyatt Riot. Not only are we going to be going through the bits and the bytes, talking about some of the most recent developments in the enterprise, but we've got a special treat for those who might live in the world of the developer. That's right. Today's enterprise is increasingly dependent on those who develop software and services. And to develop those software and services properly, you're going to need the help of some testing tools. So with that tease, let's go ahead and jump straight in with the blips. Now, 7,000. That's right, 7,000. That's the number of devices that the FBI claims they've been unable to access over an 11-month period. That's more than half of all the mobile devices involved in the agency's ongoing investigations, all because of a device encryption. Now, FBI Director Christopher Wray, at a speech he gave at the Association of Chiefs of Police, called encryption a, quote, huge, huge problem, unquote, for the agency. In a conciliatory note, Director Wray acknowledged that the issue of encryption wasn't as simple as had been suggested by U.S. law enforcement 2 years ago when they tried to portray encryption backdoors as technologically trivial. But he asserted that it was still a necessity, saying, quote, I get it. There's a balance that needs to be struck between encryption and the importance of giving us the tools we need to keep the public safe, unquote. Yet the tech-savvy and cryptologically literate have a different view of the issue. Even though most of us understand the necessity of letting law enforcement access data that has been encrypted once legally warranted, you can't legislate math. The simple fact is that the encryption genie is out of the bottle and no amount of political wrangling is going to put it back in. Still, if U.S. law enforcement is willing to work with technology companies instead of dictating terms and, more importantly, rebuild their shattered trust with the public, then there might be hope that we can walk that balance between the needs of law enforcement and the rights of the citizens that law enforcement protects.
So the ongoing net neutrality discussion just might get a little bit more interesting as the House Judiciary Committee schedules a hearing on net neutrality and the role of antitrust for November 1st. The Subcommittee on Regulatory Reform, Commercial and Antitrust Law is holding the hearing, and likely the topic will be Title II, where broadband was classified as a Title II communication service, where providers being are common carriers and not information providers. The hearing is an attempt to ensure conversations are had before the FCC puts their finishing touches on the rollback of net neutrality rules, like ban on paid prioritization of certain types of content and rules keeping internet service providers from slowing down content at their discretion. If Congress can enforce rules with a bill, it would prevent the ping pong effect each time the FCC changes hands. This might be a defining time for the movement, so if you have an opinion, make sure you contact your representative soon for support.
Well, in a complete turnaround, the FAA noted in a paper by the International Civil Aviation Organization that if a laptop's lithium-ion battery got too hot in the baggage compartment, that the potential for fires would exceed typical baggage compartment fire suppression systems. So now they're doing a 180-degree about-face and saying you can no longer check them in, even though they first required that. Even with new stricter rules going into effect this last Thursday, where you can no longer carry on laptops on international flights traveling to the U.S., my comment is, no! So now I have to carry my camera gear, my laptops, and tablets, all in a shrinking and ever more costly carry-on baggage environment. To add insult to injury, the new rules that went into effect yesterday will mean any electronic device larger than a cell phone now has to be removed from carry-on baggage up to and including passenger interviews potentially in the mix. Dang. Maybe trains are the answer since airlines can't seem to make up their mind on accommodating the business traveler.
With massive power and cooling requirements, high-density data centers with acres of roof space have been great candidates for the use of solar panels and other renewable energy sources to offset their pull from the power grid. However, even the most ambitious data farms still need grid tie-in to make up the difference between their power needs and their power generation. Or at least they did before the construction of Aruba's global cloud data center near Milan, Italy. The new 49-acre, 200,000-square-foot facility is a state-of-the-art data center with 25,000 racks, 600 kilometers of cable and fiber, 119 UPS units, 11,564 batteries, 32 generators, 192 cooling systems, 300 on-site data experts, and 150 gigabits per second of redundant connectivity. In addition to all that tech, it's also the first zero-impact, completely energy-sufficient Rating 4 facility. Now, to accomplish this feat, Aruba's data center uses a combination of solar panels and its very own hydroelectric plant that can generate up to 90 megawatts of power that can be injected back into the national power grid. To further increase their energy operation margin, the DC uses a geothermal groundwater cooling system. Groundwater at a constant 48 degrees is pumped up, used to cool the data center through heat exchangers, then returned to the water table. It's also interesting that unlike many of its brethren, which pick cheap, out-of-the-way locations, this DC is in the middle of a bustling city and next to a river that periodically floods. Representatives say that they've over-engineered the DC to account for flooding and other quote-unquote city effects, so that all that remains to be seen is if this experiment has long-term positives that can be replicated.
So capture security always seemed like a strange way to secure data entry points from bots and other automated DOS-related attacks. Why? Because can't software beat identifying content or patterns in a picture? The technology relies on the fact that computers do not have great algorithms yet to recognize random things. Well, a new startup called Vicarious AI is about to prove that CAPTCHA is no longer safe from AI itself, with their new algorithm that can easily beat the technology by also managing general text recognition. Vicarious Secret? Well, it modeled the structure of its AI on information gained from studying how mammals' visual cortex processes images. The visual cortex uses a network of neurons to isolate features and figure out by proximity which features are part of the single object. Object-based classification allow for identification of the objects no matter the orientation, color, or even changed attributes. To mimic this behavior, Vicarious created something called a recursive cortical network, or RCN. It starts by identifying features that define edges of an object as well as internal structures. The agents then pull out surface features and collections of these recognized properties, and they get grouped into pools and based on physical proximity. These pools then establish connections with other pools, and they message back and forth to influence each other, and they create groups of connected features. And by scoring this, and several rounds of scoring, they are able to then recognize objects despite moderate changes in size and orientation. How accurate is it? Well, with text, it's actually 97% accurate. Similar systems of bots today are only 57% accurate. So it sounds like CAPTCHA is on its way out. Since it doesn't require a neural network to perform its function, it lowers the bar for hardware and resources requirements. This could be a big step forward in AI, even if CAPTCHA has to suffer for it.
Google now has a bug bounty for third-party apps on the Google Play Store. All I can say is hurrah and thank you. The number of buggy programs is on the rise, and I, for one, applaud Google's move to help improve the mobile environment by paying folks to find bugs. Glad Google has a ton of bugs, since the number of buggy apps on the Play Store has been frustrating at best and malware at worst. So, Google, thank you and good hunting.
The stupid, it burns. British company Online PLC had its share price jump almost 400%. In 2 days, on volume of 2.9 million shares, equivalent to 16 times the total trading volume a year before. While we're accustomed to volatility in the markets, the reason why the company's share price jumped is a real head shaker. They changed their name to include the word blockchain. That's right, Online PLC became Online Blockchain PLC without changing anything else about their company or offerings, and were rewarded with quadrupled fortunes. The ASX-based company released a statement saying, quote, "Blockchain technology and cryptocurrencies are a new and exciting area we have been working on for some time. We feel the time is right to rename the company to reflect these developments where we believe the future growth will be in our sector," unquote. Of course, that statement was immediately followed by a cautionary note to investors that their blockchain product, with no details, is still in very early stages and that they should expect no release soon, or, I'll add, ever. Now, one thing is for sure, you'll never see these kinds of shenanigans on the Twit TV network, especially not here on This Week in Enterprise Blockchain Tech. That does it for the blips. Let's go ahead and jump into the bites. Now, you're going to love it because we're going to be talking a little bit about bug bounties. We're going to be talking a little bit about software developments. But first, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank the sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, let me ask you a question. Did you enjoy your last mortgage experience? I mean, what's not to enjoy about it? Being grilled by some rando in a suit who wants to look through all your receipts, your past pay stubs, pretty much your entire financial life fit into a banker's box in order to find out whether or not you're worthy of a mortgage. Well, of course you didn't. It's not a good experience. It's not a great experience. It's never been a great experience. And folks, especially in today's era where we expect everything to be simpler and digital, it just wasn't keeping up. Well, that's exactly what Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans figured out. They realized that the mortgage experience was not caught up with the digital world, and that's why they gave us Rocket Mortgage. Now, Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence that you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at a touch of a button. No more trying to dig up old pay stubs or canceled checks or receipts. You can do everything with a click of a button. Now, it's powerful whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th. Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds. And based on your income, your assets, and your credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options, the ones for which you qualify, and then it helps you find exactly the one that's right for you. No more trying to shoehorn you into an existing mortgage structure. They can figure out what you need, what you're looking for, and how you want to live your life, and then tell you exactly which option is the one you should choose. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. That's rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Equal housing lender license in all 50 states and MLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's kick off the bites with something that, I really don't know where to fall on this. This is something that's been developing over the last couple of weeks and actually over the last couple of years. And I want to see what my co-hosts have to say about this. Now, you've understood, if you've watched this show, that there's been this trend. More and more companies, more and more tech giants have tried to be transparent. Over the past few years, tech giants have been enticing government entities to their products by giving them access to their source code. It was a show of good faith, one that many in the community, including those here on TWiET, applauded as that movement to transparency. Well, that might be coming to an end. Now, McAfee, which, like Microsoft, had been offering world governments a peek into their code in clean rooms in order to raise confidence that there were no backdoors built into the product, has announced that it's ending the practice. Now, their reasoning is simple. It's a security risk. Though they don't have any hard evidence that such reviews have led to a security issue, there is some risk that such reviews can lead to more advanced cyber attacks on products that are targeted towards government agencies across the world. McAfee, which started offering clean room reviews while it was still part of Intel, is just the latest company that has made this move, with Symantec doing the same about 18 months ago, and smaller vendors quietly discontinuing the practice. Although all are very careful to couch the announcement as a natural evolution of business practices, sources close to the matter seem to indicate that the main problem resided in a set of clean rooms in Russia. Perhaps the era of transparency in proprietary software has once again entered a cold war. Cheebert, let me throw this to you first. Let's get some history here. Why the clean rooms in the first place? We had Microsoft, we had Apple, we had Facebook, all the security companies saying, we want you as a client, and to assure you that there are no backdoors that our government would use, we're going to let you have a peek at the source code. Why did this become popular, and why did it spread so quickly to the tech community?
It was marketing. You know, that's the long and short of it. They wanted large government contracts. They wanted them to trust their product, and it was marketing. Now, ask any developer, oh, yeah, we're going to have an independent third party come and review your code to see if you put any backdoors in. Yeah, yeah, and I'm going to like that just as much as a visit to a proctologist. So, no, it had to end someday. I wish it could continue because I love transparency, but I can't fault them for this. I really can't.
Right.
You know, more eyes on the internals of your product means more talent potentially learning how to circumvent your protection.
Yeah.
So I see both sides. You know, I like the transparency. I would love to see it continue, but I'm also a realist.
Now, Lou, you work for one of the companies that has been using clean rooms and is currently still using clean rooms, although that policy could change at any time. You've heard what Tiber just said, and I'm kind of on the same page. This was a PR thing. I never expected a whole lot of technical details to leak out through a look at code in these clean rooms because, I mean, it's not as if they could take the code home. They had to go to particular facilities that were isolated from the outside world. You could bring in one or two engineers, and they could scan the relevant sections to make sure that there wasn't any code there that might allow for a back door. So in that sense, it really seemed like, okay, it's transparency, but it's controlled transparency. It's transparency just enough to make you feel the warm and fuzzy. Does it make sense, as Chibert said, that this is coming to an end? If it was a PR stunt, the PR is now spent and there's no more use for this.
You know, I haven't heard anything from the Microsoft side, but I do know that there are a lot of organizations out there that, you know, because, you know, the ecosystems kind of require it. So when you know, no matter if you're hosting an application or if you're putting it in a store, they still have to be able to scan your, not just your binaries, but your source code regardless. And so I think these particular ecosystems are a forcing function to allow, you know, people to do that. Now, when you have actual platform developers and operating system developers like Apple and Microsoft and Google, you know, again, having people peek into the technology is not as valuable as it was anymore. One, because of the complexity of the technology. I mean, peeking into a small portion of the code base is not going to be a telling function for how safe or secure it is anymore without knowing kind of the surrounding subsystems and so on. So, you know, again, I kind of agree. It's you know, personally, I think it might have been more of a PR thing than anything to make it feel safe. But unless you have engineers, you know, clean rooms used to be that they were just these, you know, reverse engineering laboratories where people used to go in them and reverse engineer things, you know, without the help of the manufacturer or developer. And, you know, and they've kind of morphed themselves into an agreement that we open the door to a little portion of the code. But again, how useful is it? I mean, as a developer, looking at a small portion is very useful anymore. So, but again, that's only for platform developers.
Yeah. Chibert, we've got JJ to the 484 who's voicing what I think will be a question among a lot of the people listening or watching this right now. And that is, well, if you're so worried about this, why not just use open source? And I am a proponent of open source. I use several different open source suites and packages in my lab and in my infrastructure. But this is, I mean, we have to address this. Why not? Why not just switch to all Linux and all OpenOffice and all open source tools across the enterprise?
And I answer back with, why not? There's actually quite a few people that have done exactly that. But as much as I love open source and I support open source, heck, I run one of the larger Linux mirror sites on Earth. I do have one problem with a lot of open source products, in that there's so many personalities involved that what you end up with is, oh, it works on this distro, but not that distro, or I've got this dependency or that dependency, or this, you know, there's, I what I end up with is a product that I shift my costs into support. Just from a pure support standpoint, having open source does cost more because, you know, more of the support is on me. I can't call someone up and say, hey, it's broke, fix it. So, yeah, there's a lot of good things. You know, JJ does point out, yeah, there's snap packages work. You know, and I got to admit, our friends at Splunk have done a spectacular job. It's one of the few commercial packages that is based on open source that will install without making me go and dig for dependencies, you know, all day long. And the clean, easy install, the easier support, that's what people like for commercial. So, yeah, on one hand, yeah, I can have a team go and do a review on open source and make sure there's no back doors. But like Lou said, software is getting really complicated. There's an awful lot of pieces. You know, how much review are you willing to do? And you know what? Our guest today is actually going to be talking a little bit along that line, and that, you know, we need to do more testing within our organizations. And I've gone completely off the rails and not answering your question. But, you know, yeah, there's a lot of good things about open source, but trust-wise, a lot of commercial entities want to have the Microsoft or the Google or someone to be able to call up and say, it's broke, come fix it.
Right. And I mean, that was what made the clean rooms and the transparency programs from various companies attractive, in that they were giving something that was akin to open source in the sense that I can actually look at the code. But like Lou said, I mean, there's only so much you can glean from looking at a couple of sections. But at the same time, it gives me what the administrative side of me wants, and that is I have someone to blame. Let's not even call it support. It's blame. If the software breaks and it's open source and my department was responsible for upkeeping, it is my fault. There is no one else to turn to. If a server from Oracle or from Microsoft breaks, then I have someone I'm going to call at Microsoft or Oracle, and we're going to have words, and they're going to send over support, and they're going to fix it right away. Now, whether or not that is the technologically superior way to do it, it was the business superior way to handle things. Lou, let's look at this at its ultimate conclusion. So companies are going to start shutting down clean rooms because it's not getting them anything anymore. No one's trusting anybody else. All the closed source is going to get even more closed source. All the future developments are just going to be, well, trust us, it's working now. How do you see this playing out? Are we going to now further the divide between open source and closed source? Because for many years here on this show, we've seen it get closer and closer and closer. And now it seems like, okay, we're going to reverse that trend.
You know, I think the push is more like, I think we come out at the angle of open source. Like, you know, a company that I work at, you know, we're focusing a lot of time and energy on open source, not only, you know, producing open source code and platforms, but also, you know, consuming them. And so, you know, and the reason is exactly that. I mean, it gives us this ability for us to, you know, to take in, you know, use code and proven code that perform a set of functions that we require or need it to do, and then be able to scan it and make sure it's secure and it performs what we need and so on and so forth. And so that's a reason why we're moving forward with it. I mean, it, you know, even no matter how many people come in and change it, you know, we always have this ability to see what was changed and ensure it's just safe and secure. You know, from the other perspective, there's going to be always some operating systems and platforms, you know, like, for instance, I don't ever see iOS becoming open source. So, you know, these types of things are going to have to be closed source scenarios. And you know, is it still valuable to do clean rooms? I don't see them doing that. And I think that will it force a divide in open source? I don't think so. I think open source has a different value. And there will be more and more of it going forward as people want to be more and more productive when they develop software. So I don't think it's a forcing function.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think this is a natural lead into the second bite. And actually, Chiebert, you're going to run this one. Tell me a little bit about bug bounties, because if we start talking about companies and enterprises doing their due diligence in the software that, well, runs their enterprise, we got to start talking about how we're going to reward people who act responsibly when they discover vulnerabilities.
Well, you know, the bottom line is everybody likes money. Everybody likes bragging rights. And bug bounties do both. Well, sadly, I haven't found the bug yet, but I do have this really cool coin that I don't have with me right now. It's sitting on my desk at home. And it's a coin from Microsoft labeled, you know, the bug bounty program. Microsoft has had this program for a really, really long time. And if you go and find a bug in one of their products, there is a variable amount of money that they will reward you. Not only that, it's also public. You get bragging rights. Well, the reason why I kind of started this off on the bite is because Google is now officially doing it. Now, Google's had a bug bounty program for their platform for a while. What they're doing that's different is they have an independent bug bounty platform called HackerOne, and they're going after bugs in third-party apps on the Google Play Store, which is awesome because, you know, anyone that's run Android knows that you kind of cross your fingers, you install it. Will it work on my version of Android? Will it work on my phone or my tablet? And so forth. It would be really great if we could find more of these, do more testing and things like that. So what I want to do, though, is there's lots of really interesting things happening, but I want to go and give Lou a chance to go and kind of rant a little bit about the Microsoft Bug Bounty Program, because just from reading his notes, there's a lot more depth to the Microsoft Bug Bounty Program than I originally thought. I got briefed on this, I don't know, call it 8, 9, 10 years ago by some folks at Microsoft. But let's look at the insider's view. Mr. Liu, tell us more on how we can go and find bugs and make some moolah.
Absolutely. So yeah, this year alone, there's been a good majority of bug bounty programs out there. I think Kevin put the link up there before. It's mostly focusing on kind of the insider programs of different edge cases. So like, for instance, Windows Insider, whether it's Windows 10 or Office Insider. So getting kind of the edge scenarios, Windows Defender being part of that. And of course, Edge also being that as long as it's on Windows Insider Preview. And so you'll see that there's actually a range of values you can actually, the biggest one being actually Azure or Hyper-V scenarios is the big one. And they're mainly looking for things like remote code execution, information disclosure, denial of service. And depending on what they've done in order to kind of make sure you get paid out correctly, they've kind of developed a set of tiers for how they pay things out for, you know, based off of those kind of types of vulnerabilities. So like I think the first tier is the hypervisor and the host kernel, and then the next one being a virtual machine worker process, and then the next one being different components of it, remote FX, which is the UI, fiber channel adapters, that kind of thing. And based on the tier is the how much money you actually get and how it goes with it. Now, the process also breaks down even farther. So like, for instance, if you have a denial service or information disclosure, you know, whether it's a crashing the machine or it forces the VM to stop, they pay out a specific amount as well. And depending also on the quality of the report. So you can't just say, hey, this is what it does. Like if you give code or if you give examples of the attack, it's much higher quality than just kind of saying, hey, I found this. Because it helps the engineers to essentially dig down and figure out the depths of it. So the process is very similar across the board for whether it's Windows or Office or .NET or even just cloud-based ones. You just submit something over email, get a confirmation. Depending on the complexity, it takes a little bit of time for the engineers to triage those and work through them. But once, you know, you'll always be contacted on each submission, and depending on the validity of it, they will kind of go over whether you get paid or not. And also, like Jeebert was saying, is they make it public. So you get to go out and be part of the bounty honor roll wall, and you get your name put out there and what you found. But here's kind of the kicker. Similar to how Google security works today, where they go out and they have researchers and they find security flaws and they post the code publicly and everything. It's not the same here. Like, most of these programs require that if you submit, you kind of agree to a terms of service of saying that you, if you submit something, you can't expose the exploit, whether it's the code or the exploit, publicly until Microsoft is kind of ready. And this makes sense because they obviously don't want vulnerabilities floating around. I'm curious to see if Google does the same thing with theirs, because they have one department that goes and finds all these vulnerabilities and then, you know, puts them out on the public with the code and everything before sometimes they contact the company. And then now they have their own. So I wonder if they ask the same in their terms of service. I haven't read through theirs, but it's kind of a similar process. So that's kind of how it goes. And again, there's a set of ranges that kind of go along with it when it comes to these the different tiers.
Yeah, it's interesting because one of the things that I've seen with the bug bounty people is it attracts a certain type of people. You have to want to be responsible, because as much money as you can get from the bug bounty, it is nowhere near what you could get if you actually discover a high-level zero day. A perfect example of this would be when the Stage Fright vulnerability was found in Android. We actually interviewed the people who found it at DEF CON and Black Hat last year. And they realized that the $1,337, the LeadSpeak people will know what that means, that Google paid them was nowhere near what they could have made just by releasing that into some forums. They could have made on the order of, you know, millions and millions of tens of millions of dollars. So if you're going to have a bug bounty, you're going to attract a certain type of person. And that certain type of person is someone who maybe wants to make a little bit of money, but more than that, wants to make a name. And that's why it's important that these are public. These are published publicly. Cheebert, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say, I try to tell people that bug bounties are actually an extension of your DevOps team. You know, you obviously pay your people to find bugs. Well, just pay, you know, other people to find help you find bugs. It's not an outsider saying, "Nah, nah, 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 I found a bug." No, it's someone that wants to go and help. So I personally think, you know, one of the things we need to do is make these people that are good at debugging and finding problems, make them famous. You know, in the classified world, we have an acronym called MICE: money, ideology, conscience, and ego. Those are the four factors that, you know, we say will cause someone to, you know, spy or, you know, steal things or whatever. Let's go and use ego and encourage people to help find bugs, because obviously we can't match the money, but let's go and match the ego.
Right, right. And actually, for the company that found Stage Fright, that was their big entree onto the world stage. And now when they release things, they can always lean back on that. So they see it as the development of all of their business. Jeebert, this is exactly what you touched on. And, you know, I'm wondering, Lou, for Microsoft, because Cheebert and I both met the people at Microsoft who were involved in the bug bounty. And yes, I do have my coin. I love that coin. We were able to trade that coin in to go to a special party, but I thought the coin was much cooler, and I don't drink, so I just kept that thing. Microsoft must go through its own process. We know that. Microsoft has engineers who do nothing but hammer on the code and hammer on the different versions, the release candidates, to find things. How integrated is the bug bounty project into their process of bug seeking?
So there's two parts. I mean, there's, you know, obviously engineers internally, like you said, their sole job is to find issues. But, you know, there's like a ton of different avenues when it comes to bugs. Like, there's people who will go out and will post it on some, you know, GitHub that's owned by Microsoft, or they'll go out and put a user voice out there, or they'll go through support and say, hey, I have this issue. I'm seeing this issue. So there's many different avenues, and a lot of these avenues kind of lead to the same thing. Each feature team triages these things, and they keep them high priority, and based on the level of seriousness, how many customers it affects, how widespread it is, it's different priority based on for each engineering team. So one of the things that bug bounties do is they expose very, really high priority items. And if they're real, if they come in as really high tier priority items, they're taken just as seriously as, you know, a really widespread, highly visible issue, such as a crash or a failure or blue screen or that kind of thing. That's widespread. So I think that the priority is much higher from the beginning, from the get-go, for kind of bug bounty scenarios. So, but either way, they're handled the similar, if not the same, as things that are found in other channels.
Got it. Well, gentlemen, all this talk about bug bounties makes me think that this might be the perfect time to introduce our guests. We've been talking about bug bounties. We've been talking about security. We've been talking about what's going to be happening with transparency disappearing and enterprises hopefully taking security a bit more seriously. Well, I can think of no better person to talk about that than our guest, Mr. Lubosh Parobek. Hopefully I said that properly, from Sauce Labs. Lubosh, thank you very much for coming on to This Week in Enterprise Tech.
My pleasure. Really excited to discuss this topic.
Now, you've been listening for a while, but before we get into the whole what you can do for dev side, can you tell me a little bit about Sauce Labs? I already love the name, but what is Sauce Labs? When was it founded? And what is it that you do?
Yeah. So Sauce Labs was founded in 2008. We're really all about trying to speed up testing and by extension app development by allowing organizations to get rid of all that test infrastructure in terms of all the different devices and browsers that they've got to keep up to date to test for compatibility. And so we have a cloud-based service where you can go ahead and run both manual as well as automated tests against thousands of combinations of real devices as well as virtual machines and virtual mobile devices. And so it removes a lot of cost and effort of trying to maintain all those devices and browsers internally.
Right. Okay. Now, this is one of these interesting things, because whenever we bring it up, people say, oh, well, yeah, we've talked about devs before. And we have. We brought it up several times on This Week in Enterprise Tech. And they kind of understand why an enterprise would want to develop its own resources inside dev and DevOps. But why haven't we? It's been one of these things that it gets folded into IT. Sometimes it's owned its own department. Sometimes it's part of security. When the typical CIO or CTO thinks of spooling up a dev project, what do they think of? What do they think the responsibilities of that team will be?
Yeah, it's interesting. So especially with the focus on consumerization, on providing a great experience, digital experience, regardless of what kind of organization you are, whether you're a software company, an auto manufacturer, a bank, there's a lot more focus on quality. And making sure that you're providing an experience that's top notch, and in order to do that, you really need to be thinking about what are the different devices that my users are going to be testing on, what are the different browsers they're going to be using, and how am I going to make sure that I can I can provide that quality experience, and so and how can I do that at speed, right? How can I get these apps out quickly, and the only way to do that is to really think about automating testing. And that requires a lot of infrastructure. It's very, very expensive to maintain all that infrastructure yourself, which kind of leads to that consideration of cloud-based options like Sauce Labs.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about that infrastructure. Let's talk about that expensive testing, because I come from the days of the shoot from the hip startup here in the Silicon Valley, where testing was you might literally buy 50 devices and have them in a lab, and you run a couple of tests on them, make sure that the app, the service is working properly, and then you push it out the door.
Yeah.
Once we automate that, where does the cost come from? Where does it become complicated?
Yeah, that's a good point. And, one of the things that we've of course, have seen is this real movement from commercial tools for testing. You know, you think about 20 years ago, Mercury Interactive and those types of tools over to the open source world. So technologies like Selenium for web testing, open source technologies like Selenium for web testing, Appium for mobile testing. And so the first inclination of folks is like, hey, I'm gonna spin up a Selenium grid internally. I'm gonna spin up an Appium grid internally. I'm gonna do this myself. And actually, that initial creating that initially is really not that expensive. What ends up happening though is scaling that, and maintaining that is where that's really expensive. So if you think about the evergreen browsers, for example, you've got Chrome and Firefox that are usually four different releases coming out every year. And then you think about how quickly iOS comes out with not necessarily major versions but minor versions, and how fast users go to those new versions. How can you make sure that you've got all that available and that you've got that available at scale, to test against? The scale part is really important. One of the things I talk to customers about is we're really at the second wave of automated testing. That kind of initial wave was that Mercury Interactive, and it was, hey, I'm going to take a manual test case and I'm just going to automate it, right? And nothing else changed, right? Everything, the way dev worked, the way QA worked, everything was the same. I was just taking a manual process and automating. Well, in this second wave, and we're, at Sauce, we kind of discuss it as continual testing. It's completely, everything's changed. So not only are we thinking about automating the tests, but the whole relationship between dev and test has changed. So, think about agile and we no longer have two separate teams, developers and QA, but everybody's on the same Scrum team. And it's no longer, hey, I'm going to spend, a couple weeks or a month writing code, and I'm going to spend, a couple weeks or a month testing it. It's happening together at the same time, in a 2-week period. And so what that's driven is this need for velocity. I can't, kick off some regression testing that's going to last for 2 or 3 days. Our most advanced customers are doing, full regression suites in a few minutes. And what that means is that you need to be able to test in parallel, and you need to be able to test in scale. So, our largest customers, for example, have run thousands of tests in parallel so that they can get through large suites. They can test very broadly against lots of different platforms in a very short period of time and keep that velocity going so that they can get releases out quickly. So it's really the paradigm shift has been massive in terms of that. And it's also meant that, for the tester, the set of skills have changed too. Before it was, okay, I'm going to learn some type of record and playback tool, or I'm going to learn some kind of scripting language. But with this, with this move to, continuous integration in particular, these new open source technologies, there are a variety of new skills that these folks need to pick up.
I like the fact that you've pointed out that it's not just an advancement of the scale, but it's also an advancement of how we actually develop. You're right. Mm-hmm. In the old days, it used to be, oh, well, here's a release candidate, test this. Now it's, no, every time you make a change, it should be simple for you to start testing against it. It should right. no longer be an event. It should be part of the process. Bear with me. I'm more of a hardware person, and one of the devices that Chiebert introduced me to was an Ixia box. His was the first time I ever got to play with an actual network stress tester, along with a malware generator. And it was amazing to have that power where I could generate enough traffic and enough exploit attempts against a new piece of equipment that within a day or two, I could find all of the potential zero-day avenues into that piece of gear. Is there something similar on the software dev side? Is there something that I plug in, I flip a switch, and it just runs, and I can, with relative assurance, think I found all the holes?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think it's something that's right now it's emerging. So if we look at testing, and what Sauce Labs provides today, it's really functional testing. It's going through and acting as a user to exercise the UI in an automated way to go ahead and find functional issues. Now, we believe that is just the tip of the spear, and that is one of the first things people are saying. Testing is shifting left, and exactly what you mentioned, we're finding that all of a sudden, instead of testing happening at the end of development, it's moving left. It's moving to while the code is being done. Now, what's shifted left first has been unit tests and now these functional tests. But you know, we really believe that other testing is gonna move that way as well. So today, often in software, that load stress, the performance testing, you know, the security testing, the visual testing even is done, you know, kind of at the end still, not while dev is happening. But we firmly believe that that's going to move left as well. There are technologies today for doing some, and again, the reason for that, just to highlight, is because it speeds everything up, right? If you can find those security vulnerabilities, like you said earlier, you can fix them earlier, and it's easier and faster versus waiting until the end when maybe you've forgotten, you know, what you did a week ago in terms of that code and have to refresh your memory. So, you know, catching those bugs early, fixing them quickly is a key to velocity and efficiency, and we think we're going to shift left. Now, there are some open source tools for doing this. Zap Proxy is a good example of something that developers can run, you know, on every, you know, pull request or on every merge to go ahead and try to do some scanning and identify common vulnerabilities. But I think we're going to actually see more there. I think the next two non-functional testing areas we're going to see shift left more into kind of the continuous integration world are security and performance. I firmly believe that.
We've got a discussion going on in our chat room right now with JJ to the 484 and Chumley, and they're talking about, okay, they see the value of automated tests, but now they're going back and forth about the value of keeping humans in the loop. I mean, if my automated test is as advanced as you might seem to suggest, wouldn't it be better just to trust the algorithm? Why put a human into the loop where the human might introduce an error out of bias?
Yeah. No, that's a great question. And we continue to see a role for manual testing or live testing, as some folks call it. Two main areas for that we see, or actually three, I would say. So one is simply exploratory testing. You're going to want to be able to go in there and have a QA professional that is really familiar with the app, is really familiar with the customer workflows and how they want to use that app, and really test the boundaries, right? Try to break that thing. And in terms of, you know, people's ingenuity, you know, it far surpasses any algorithm today. So having that kind of belt and suspenders is super important. And I'd say the second piece is user acceptance testing, you know, getting that app out and having users actually try it and be happy with the fit and finish and you know, the professionalism is again something you really can't code up, and it's kind of an important final check to make sure, yeah, you know, it's thumbs up, I'm ready to ship this out the door. I guess the third case that I would say is, you know, manual testing, and we see this on our service a lot, also comes in very handy for debugging, right? So you'll run an automated test, you get a lot of results on that automated test, you get a set of, you know, Selenium logs, you get a screenshots and a video you can watch, but often that's not enough to debug the actual issue. You need to go back in and kind of walk through manually to see where that problem is. So I would say there's still definitely a role for manual testing for the long term.
Okay, now let me ask you this. I see where this would be incredibly beneficial when I'm testing my platform. I, you know, turn the key as I do my development process, and I can say, okay, look, it looks like it's okay. It looks like it's going to pass. It looks like it's going to work across all the different platforms I want it to work on, and it looks like I haven't put anything in the code that's going to be egregiously easy to exploit. However, there is something that is relatively new in especially the enterprise development world where I have to rely on other platforms. I might be running my service in a hybrid model where some of it is on-premise, some of it is up in the Amazon cloud, maybe some in the Microsoft or the Google cloud, and I might be even using a third, fourth party that's also using third parties in order to get my service to where I need it to be. Mm-hmm. How do I automate testing of that? Because it seems like it's so far beyond my control that I've got multiple entities outside of my policy that can make a change which suddenly makes my entire service vulnerable.
Yeah, I would say there's two ways we see our customers doing this. One is to basically say, hey, I understand I'm not in 100% control here. And they'll go ahead and mock or use service visualization to basically say, hey, I'm going to test and validate what I'm in control of and make sure that's solid. And kind of not really, you know, directly from an end-to-end test perspective, test those other bits. Now they'll often go in and do that testing through other tools. So they might have some API testing tools, et cetera, that they'll go and validate those, but they'll basically split the testing regimen into two halves. One, which is focused on kind of what can they control, and again, they'll mock to make sure that they're just testing that piece, and then maybe they'll have another set of API testing perhaps to test the pieces they're not in control of. And we definitely see even when it's just internal to a company and they have back end and front end teams, we often see this dynamic where the front end team will, for example, just be testing their front end bits with a mock back end. The other option, of course, and the beauty of functional testing is you can actually, they call it end to end testing, because if you don't mock that all out, you are going to go through and test the whole thing, regardless of whether you have third-party dependencies or not. You're going to go, when you run that end-to-end test and have everything wired up, you are going to test that. Now, of course, if something's broken, it might not be in your control and you need to go get somebody to help you, but you'll see that. One of the things that we see our customers doing when they're in this kind of situation is to continue to run these functional tests, even in production. And so they'll pick a couple key workflows, and they'll say, hey, for these key workflows, we're going to go ahead and run functional tests every few minutes to alert us if a third party service might go down. They don't do their full regression suite or anything, but they'll pick if you're an e-commerce vendor, for example, they might have a checkout flow that they just want to make sure is working no matter what. And of course they're monitoring with other tools like New Relic, et cetera, but they will continue to run some functional tests on that as well.
I would assume the dev team would prefer to receive a notification from Sauce Labs that something was insecure rather than from a customer. Probably.
Yeah, absolutely.
Works a little bit better. Oh, okay, let's back off a little bit. Let's go to the 10,000-foot level. I am a startup, and my product, my service is starting to boom. I'm starting to spread it. I'm starting to scale it. I approach Sauce Labs, and I say, okay, I need your help because I'm now growing beyond what my team can do. I'm growing beyond even what my automated in-house tools can do.
Yep.
How do I approach Sauce Labs? How do I know which questions to ask? And what are the mistakes that are made most often that keep people from getting the proper service that they need to scale their app?
Yeah, that's a great question. Sauce Labs is kind of this infrastructure cloud, is just part of a fairly complex ecosystem. And often customers underestimate the amount of work required to get the rest of their delivery pipeline into shape. And there's a couple pieces to that. One of the areas that we see customers often not being prepared for is getting their testing framework. So these are things like JUnit or TestNG if you're a Java shop, or Cucumber if you're a Ruby shop, and making sure those are in a healthy state and can scale, can run tests in parallel in an efficient way. They're great tools, they're open source, but there's a certain amount of work that you need to do to make sure that they're up to speed. So that's an area we often get involved with and consult on. We actually publish kind of modified frameworks that show kind of our best practices in terms of test parallelization and how to work with Sauce Labs. The other area that often can be challenging for customers is to write their tests also in a way that they're easy to run in parallel, and also that they're reliable. So just as I mentioned, keeping the grid maintained is challenging. Probably the biggest part of automated testing is not writing the tests initially, but keeping them well maintained so that they stay reliable and they aren't brittle. So we often often help customers make sure they're following best practices, keeping your tests autonomous, atomic, a variety of best practices to make sure that they run quickly, they can run in parallel, and they stay reliable over the long term. But I would say that those are probably two of the biggest things to think about is some of the infrastructure issues, both around the framework you're using, sometimes around the CI, the continuous integration server, if you're using Jenkins or Travis, or those things can sometimes be a bottleneck too in terms of scaling up your testing. So those would be the key things that I would look at in terms of making sure you're ready for getting into scale with a service like Sauce Labs.
Thank you, Lubosch. Now, I do want to bring in my co-host, and luckily I have a co-host who is involved in dev on a daily basis. Lou Maresca, I want to bring you in here because hopefully you can elevate the conversation past my layman's understanding of dev teams. What are the things that you, as a leader of several projects, have to consider when you start doing automated tasks?
You know, from the first thing is there's a lot of different layers within an application. I mean, they've been pointed out, obviously, there's view layers and UI layers. There's underlining middle tier layers and service layers. And, you know, a lot of organizations tend to start at the layers that have less automation requirements because they automation, like was said before, is tends to necessarily be semi less reliable. Like, for instance, if I need to automate a test on one browser, on a next browser, on one operating system, on another operating system, sometimes these operating systems and browsers, the automation environments tend to be unreliable. You can't get the same numbers out of them all the time. They can't be run very quickly. And so testing at the next layer down tends to happen more, and being able to even generate testing at that layer is even more valuable. Things like IntelliTest and stuff like that is super important. I'd be curious to know it, you know, like as a startup, you know, I'm starting from the scratch. A low barrier of entry is really important because and being able to be provided really good patterns and practices to follow is really important so that I can kind of scale it out and be able to kind of test all different variants. I'm curious, you know, from a Sauce Labs perspective, do they help walk people through, hey, this is the type of application you have, this is the type of framework you should use, and this is the reliability numbers that come along with it?
Yeah, absolutely. We try to provide a lot of guidance when it comes to testing best practices. I definitely, you know, agree with your point. When thinking about a testing strategy, you need to be thinking about all the layers. You know, what are the unit tests you're going to do? What are the integration tests you're going to do? What are the functional tests you're going to do? And a common mistake is to, you know, rely too heavily on, you know, functional or end-to-end tests. So making intelligent decisions there about the correct balance is vitally important. You know, customers come at us in a variety of maturities, and ironically, you know, that doesn't really necessarily vary by customer size. You know, we have very mature customers that come in, you know, large and small sizes, and the opposite is true as well. You know, for mature customers, it's a really simple solution because it's taking the same, you know, Selenium scripts, the same Appium scripts that they run today, and simply pointing them at our service. It's literally, you know, changing a few lines of code and you're up and running. So for the mature customers, you know, super easy. For the immature customers, there's a little bit of more, you know, there's a little more heavy lifting required. You know, often we'll get customers that are looking for just a quick win in terms of platform coverage. So if you think about, real devices, and like you said, you know, getting those 50, you know, real devices that we mentioned at the beginning doesn't seem like it's a hard problem, but it's actually pretty challenging to keep doing that right on a budget. You know, buying those new phones every time they come out and getting them same day, right? You really want to send somebody out to the Apple store to wait in line to get a new phone. So one of the immediate benefits we provide even to the least mature companies is the ability to just have a very broad range of things to test against for compatibility. That's not only important from as you're developing the app perspective, but you can imagine you get a call from the field saying, hey, your app doesn't work on, you know, this phone that's, you know, this many operating system releases back. How do you reproduce and fix that, right? And so having these thousands of devices in the cloud where you can just go reproduce that is super handy. The next phase is definitely, well, how do we get people from that into, you know, writing automated tests? And we have a technical services group that helps with that in terms of, you know, teaching best practices in terms of frameworks and test scripting. We also have a host of free online content around these subjects. So for folks that want to go in and get training on their own, that's an area of increasing investment for us, where we really want to be able to provide a lot of free education on automated testing best practices.
So I've got this question. I used to use Mercury Interactive for a lot of my InfoWorld articles, and shall we say writing those scripts were cumbersome, but in those days we actually used to just call it load testing. You know, can I even handle X number of users? Mm-hmm. So we're in the next generation. What kind of actionable types of alerts or reports can I get from something like what Sauce Labs does?
Yeah. Sauce Labs, you know, is a little bit different than that. So we don't do the load and stress testing. It's purely a kind of a functional testing solution. And what we provide is basically you'll have typically what a functional test looks like is literally a series of actions that a user might do. So go to this, you know, URL, you know, put focus on the login, you know, field for, you know, for login name, put that in, put the focus in on password, put the password in, tap the login button. I expect to see login success. And so what we would produce is literally, and each of those actions corresponds to a kind of a Selenium command. And what you would see is basically in our UIs, you'd see a set of those commands. And for each of those commands, you would see the result and whether it was successful or not. And then finally, whether the, you know, the assertion passed, being basically that you saw success. Along with that, we provide a screenshot. So every time you do a an action, there's a screenshot, and then a video of the whole thing. And then finally, we provide a series of logs. And we're actually spending the logs that we have. So traditionally, provide a Selenium log that gives a lot more detail in terms of what's happening behind the scenes with Selenium. But we just actually announced two additional testing assets. One is the JavaScript console log, which provides a lot of good detail. There is, like, while all these commands are running, you know, were there any exceptions, JavaScript exceptions, so you can see that. And then we're also publishing the HAR file, so the HTTP archive file. And this basically tracks all of the network requests and responses that happened while those commands were executing. And so, it's a really easy way to go. If something failed in that process, you can go through and say, oh, okay, I see what happened. You know, this request for a particular element, you know, failed, a backend service wasn't working, et cetera. So that kind of is in a nutshell what we provide in terms of helping you, you know, see what happened during a test and then debug any failures.
So one question I had, there, you know, obviously Sauce Labs is doing some amazing stuff, and I want to kind of call that out because we have seen it being used and it's kind of cool stuff. But I wanted to throw that out there as well, is there are some other kind of, I wouldn't say competitors, but there are some other companies in this space, you know, like Amazon Device Farm, AWS Device Farm, there's Xamarin Test Laboratories, there's Cobotan, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, but there's a bunch of other ones in this space. What do you, you know, how do you kind of compare for those, and what kind of unique thing is Sauce Labs offering from them?
Yeah, no, great question. So a couple different things that we like to focus on. One is we believe that we've got industry leading scalability and reliability. So as I mentioned, we've got customers that are testing, running tests in the thousands, all in parallel. We believe that's unique in the industry. We actually have very, very low error rates, infrastructure error rates. That's a key reason lots of customers switch to us. It's important because error rates result in unreliable tests, also referred to as flaky tests, and it really undermines the confidence in automated testing. So reliability and scalability of our service is something that I would definitely call out as a key differentiator. The other area is the completeness of our solution, in that we test across both web applications as well as native app applications. And we do that across a variety of different device types. So we've got desktop VMs, you know, Mac and Windows. We have virtual mobile devices, emulators and simulators, as well as real mobile devices. So actual, like, iPhones and Android devices in racks in a data center. We believe that each of these has a really important place in testing. So just to give a couple examples, for web applications these days, most people are moving to responsive applications, and you're going to want to make sure that, you know, your web app doesn't just, you know, function correctly, you know, on a desktop, but on a mobile device, and often you're going to want to do that at scale. And so, you know, being able to run that across our desktop VMs and emulator simulators is really important. If we turn over to native apps often have dependencies on hardware, you know, cameras, you know, GPS, etc. And so often it's really important to run those on real devices, and we offer that, of course, as an option as well. In the real device space, we offer both private and public clouds. And so, again, that broad selection of, you know, that broad solution, we believe is unique right now through a kind of a single platform.
We have been speaking with Lubos Parobek. Lubos, have to say your name properly once for me. I always have problems with these kinds of names. So how does it sound?
No problem. Lubos Parobek.
Lubos Parobek, because that was kind of close. He is the VP of product over at Sauce Labs. I want to thank you so very much for being part of this episode. Unfortunately, we've done it again. We've used up another hour. Listen to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 automated tools. I do want to give you time, though, to give our audience a parting shot. If they're considering looking at automated tools, what's one piece of wisdom that you want them to walk away from this show with?
You know, what I would look at is really thinking through, you know, what you want to accomplish internally versus externally. A lot of our customers kind of wrestle with this idea of what makes sense to do, you know, in-house versus externally. And it all comes down to, you know, prioritization and what you want to spend your time on. You know, most, you know, don't find that, you know, spending time on an internal Selenium or Appium grid makes sense, and that outsourcing that is the best bet. So I would say think through your options. There's often more reliable, faster ways to do things.
Yeah, fantastic. And finally, is there any place that you'd like to send people? This is your time. You've given us the knowledge that we need. Now, where can they find Sauce Labs? Where can they find you? Where do they go to see what the future of automated testing looks like?
Absolutely. So please go to saucelabs.com. We have a 14-day free trial. It'll allow you to have full access to our service. You'll have desktop VMs, emulators, simulators, real devices, all right there. And you can try out the service, run your automated tests, run some manual tests, and see what value we can provide for you.
Lubash, thanks again for being part of this episode. And the Twiat Riot thanks you.
Very welcome. I appreciate it.
Folks, we also need to thank, well, my co-hosts. I couldn't do this show without them. They're the ones who are feeding me wonderful intelligence, even when you can't see them on the screen. It includes Chibert, who is also our super producer. He's the one who actually gets us the guests that you enjoy listening to. And Lou, who will, I mean, there's got to be someone in our group who actually knows what he's doing. Chibert, could you please tell the folks at home what you're doing, where they can find you when you're not melting in your lab, and hopefully what they could do to help Hawaii remove the scourge of slow speed internet.
Loon? Could we have a string of loons going to California?
Actually, that'd be kind of cool, actually. I didn't review that.
Anyway, reach out to me. I'm ADVNETLAB on Twitter, or Chibert at twit.tv. And love to hear from you. JJ keeps feeding me some great guests. We actually have someone talking about some really amazing open source hosting and virtualization coming up on December 22nd. So don't turn us off during the holidays. Anyway, drop in, drop out, and throw your show ideas at us.
Fantastic. And Lou Maresca, I understand that you've got a Microsoft Halloween party coming through in a bit, so you're probably going to be pretty busy, yes?
Yeah, it's for the kids, so I'm going to bring my three sons, and we're going to go over, and we're going to do a little trick-or-treating. It's always fun for them.
What do they hand out at a Microsoft Halloween party? Is it like Surface tablets and such?
I wish. It's really, actually really good candy, though. They give the big stuff, so I'm looking forward to it myself.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing about Halloween. There's always that house that doesn't do the fun size. They do the full-size candy bar, and those are always the best. But where can people find you?
So you can always find my work. Dev.office.com is my team's work. And, of course, you can always find what I'm doing and my little side projects and so on. You can always check me out at LouMM on Twitter.
Fantastic. Lou, Brian, thank you so very much again. Wouldn't want to do Twiat without you. Also, thanks to you. To the person who comes back every week and watches or listens to the show. Without you, we don't have an audience. Without an audience, we don't have Twiat. We want to make it easier for you to get all the enterprise goodness that you want. Just go to our show page at twit.tv/Twiat. There you'll find not only all of our back episodes, but also our show notes. If you want to see the links for the stories that we talked about, or perhaps you want to get contact information for one of our guests or the companies that they represent, that's where you go. Again, twit.tv/KH. Also, I forgot which show I'm doing right now. Also, don't forget that you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you follow me there, you'll see which show I'm actually doing at that particular moment. And like, for this was for know-how. This was for KH. That's Jason Howell playing with the new Microsoft Mixed Reality Unit, which, by the way, is freaking awesome. You're going to want to watch know-how and the new screensavers to see exactly what we did with that. It's pretty fun stuff. Again, twitter.com/PadreSJ. J. Finally, thanks to everyone here who makes this show possible, to Lisa and Leo, of course, who have allowed us to continue doing Twyatt for, what, going on to 6 years now. Wow, how is that even possible? And also to our fantastic TD. Yes, you know him as Shark Boy. It's Kevin. Kevin, this is the time of the show where we try to grant you some redemption by asking you something about the knowledge that was spread during the show. Are you ready for this week's question?
No.
Okay, well, the question is, our guest was from a company called Sauce Labs. What is the flavor of that sauce?
Barbecue.
I'm sorry. The answer was awesome. Awesome Sauce Labs. Kevin, that's okay. Maybe you can try again next week. Until then, I'm Father Robert Balasair, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep quiet.